And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a very special Overdrive edition of the Hagman Report. I'm Doug Hagman. I want to thank you for your belief and trust in this platform and in me. I am traveling today, headed to Washington, D.C., the last place I want to be. I'm going to be gone for a couple of days. Tomorrow, I'm going to be, you're going to be treated to a program with myself and Randy Taylor as Wednesday as well. So don't miss those two programs. And please share this program, the links to this program from HagmanReport.com with everyone you know, because I think today, I think I've got a lot of information I want to give to you that I think will be useful in looking at the bigger picture of things. I'm a big picture guy, you know that. And there's a lot of, really a lot of things that are kind of connecting, a lot of dot connecting going on here. A couple of things I want to dispense with first. And pretty interesting. We had, and forgive my looking down and paper rattling here, have so many papers all over the place, but it's important really to cover so much of this. Mayra Flores was sworn in this past weekend as the representative of the 34th District of Texas. I don't know if you caught this or not. I just want to put this out there to show you what's going on with, show you that, I want to show you Nancy Pelosi, all right? I want to show you what she did during the swearing-in photo op time period. Now, Mayra Flores is the first Mexican-born House member, if I'm correct in this. Her husband is a Border Patrol agent. But what's important here is not that. It is the behavior of Nancy Pelosi. Now, as an investigator, I'm a big believer in body language, behavioral analysis. And the reason I bring this up is it's not what you might expect. I believe in my heart of hearts that what we're looking at here is a level of discontent and even discombobulation among those people in power. They're scared, they're worried, they're concerned, and they're losing their composure in public. So imagine what they're doing in private. That's kind of why I want to show you this, this video clip. This had been making the rounds on social media over the last day or so. And what Nancy Pelosi does, and you're going to see this in this clip, but for the radio listeners, what she does is she uses her elbow to push away a young, Mayra Flores' young daughter, okay? And you can see the disgust, the disdain, even if it's rather subtle, you can see it. The reason I'm showing you this is I believe that the people in power, people like Pelosi and others, are starting to lose their public composure because of the stresses brought forth by we the people. It's sort of like in an interview or an interrogation room. When you conduct an interview, when a police officer conducts an interview, investigator conducts an interview, there are certain things that you look for in people to see, you know, where they're at and if they're going to break. Okay. And this to me is a big deal in that respect. So from that in that context, I want you to take a look at this. Now I'm going to share this screen. Eric, the tech also is, not with me today as well. And he won't be with me tomorrow or Wednesday. This is something I've got to take care of. And, again, you know, folks, it's just one of those things. So, again, more on that when I can give it. All right. But take a look at this video clip. Now I'm going to share this. I don't know how well this is going to work. I'm not a tech, so hang with me here. Let me see what I can do. All right, here it is here. Let me put forth this clip. This is not the right one, of course. I should have had this. Okay, here we go. Now take a look at this, and you can read the comments from the Twitter clip, but watch this. Again, this is the swearing in of Mayra Flores from the 34th District of Texas. And on your screen, you see, of course, center screen, Nancy Pelosi, Ms. Flores's husband, directly beside, if you're looking at her at the screen, it would be on your right, Pelosi's left, and then to the right of Pelosi are Flores's two young daughters. Now watch this. I'm going to go ahead and click play, and then I think it'll come back in a slow motion view as well. Here it is. Watch this.
We wanted our pastor to come into the picture. Pastor.
Now, did you see that? Now, here it is in slow motion. Now, watch Nancy Pelosi. That's a shove, all right? That's a shove of a young girl. I don't know how old she is, but she's very young, obviously under maybe 10 years old, 10, 11 years old. But again, I'm showing this in the context of the leaders, the people who are running things. They're losing it. And they're showing their breaking point, or they're showing that they are breaking in public. Okay, so imagine what's taking place in private. So there's that. I just want to dispense with that. And again, the story is not necessarily the shove, although that's bad enough. Oops. How do I? I got to stop that. Let me stop that completely here. Hopefully that'll work. All right. Again, I apologize for the amateur-like presentation here because of the because of my lack of knowledge with respect to how to work these on-screen play things. Okay. Now, so again, I believe that there is a level of sweat taking place. So imagine yourself. You're a Christian conservative. You're pushing for change. You're yelling. You are attempting to change things, and it's working. I believe to some extent it's working. Look at the outrage about Roe v. Wade, and I'm going to be getting into that in a moment as well. Not necessarily all of the stuff that you see on social media or other people are talking about. I'm talking about from a different perspective, which I think is even more important. Maybe you haven't heard the perspective which I want to address. And by the way, Roe v. Wade is not the only thing that happened in the Supreme Court, but that's getting the most attention. Because that, of course, I mean, that's a huge issue, but that's also a soundbite issue as well. And not to diminish the importance of that, but it's easier in a soundbite. Whereas the Second Amendment decision last week about New York State essentially becoming a may issue to a shall issue state, and that's a very and again, pardon me for saying this, but that's a very broad brush stroke of that decision. But what the Supreme Court said, essentially, New York State is, look, you cannot ask for a reason why somebody needs to, when they apply for a concealed weapons permit, you know, why do you need it? That question needn't be asked. Okay, so that's just, and that's gonna have larger implications down the road. But there's also a second or a third opinion coming out. It should have already been out today. I haven't checked, but that's about the climate change, carbon emissions decision. You're going to be hearing more about that, and I'll be getting into that later in the week as well. So where are we at right now with all of these issues? I kind of want to I want to touch on a few things here. I want to get into one of the big things that we saw last week is Merrick Garland. I did not really give much. I didn't give much to this, much time to this, but I'm going to show you on the screen here. This, I believe, is from the Federalist, and I'm going to share my screen here again. This is not necessarily anything that you have to, or I have to, this is not a video, this is an article. And I do want to show this, however. So here this is, and the title is Merrick Garland's Department of Justice is a Threat to the Republic. Now, this is all going to kind of run together, and here it is on the screen. And for the radio audience, obviously, I've got the audio and as well as the video, but for the radio audience, it does point out that it's become painfully obvious over the past year that the Justice Department under Garland has been weaponized and politicized to the point that it represents an active threat to the rule of law and separation of powers. Okay, that is absolutely true. And the author adds, it's not too much to say that Garland's Department of Justice has become a threat to the Republic. Now, a couple of things mentioned this past week, Thursday, last week, Thursday, 6-3 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that struck down New York for violating states' residents' Second Amendment rights. Now, here is the key aspect to this. Department of Justice spokeswoman released a statement saying, we respectfully disagree with the ruling. All right, writes the author. The ruling is, of course, a great victory for the Constitution and a long overdue vindication of New Yorkers' Second Amendment rights. Now, I know somebody personally in New York, a pretty high-profile individual, declined the CCW permit, the concealed weapons permit, while under threat, and it was very interesting to watch. So if that individual suffered in that respect, so many others, not so high profile people, have suffered. But having said all of that, the author writes that this ruling, of course, is a great victory for the Constitution and a long overdue vindication of New Yorkers' Second Amendment rights. True. The law in question had been on the books for more than a century, made it nearly impossible for ordinary people like you and me to obtain a concealed carry license. The unconstitutional law forced New Yorkers to prove to a municipal bureaucrat that they needed a gun for self-defense. In practice, this made it almost impossible for law-abiding citizens in New York to exercise their right to bear arms, okay, under the Constitution. It continues, but neither the law in question nor the Supreme Court's decision implicates federal gun laws in any fashion. There's no reason for the Department of Justice to weigh in on the matter or express any opinion whatsoever on the ruling. Only an utterly politicized Justice Department hoping to undermine the Supreme Court's constitutional authority and sow the seeds of nullification would issue such a statement. There it is. So we have this weaponized Department of Justice. Not news to you. I've been talking about this for a long time. And you know, look, we've experienced it. I've experienced this. Of course, not to this extent, and not under these circumstances. But when you become the target of a Department of Justice dislike, or in this case, what is that? We don't agree with this. When you become that target, as I said before, the process becomes the punishment. And again, I have spent myself and Steve Quayle and we have been targets where the process has become the punishment. And I'm telling you, folks, when you find yourself in a position like that, whether it be a public entity like the Department of Justice or a government entity like the Department of Justice or a private entity sponsored by a public by a government entity, the process can bankrupt you. It could debilitate you, even emotionally. Okay. I'm telling you, your business suffers. Everything suffers. And people, I believe all of us are going to find out very personal. This is going to be a personal thing for all of us. Even if you think you're so far under the radar that you don't have to worry about a thing, you so much as say something at a school board meeting or say something even on social media, this can affect you. But the article continues. And again, this relates to the New York decision now. Breaking: Department of Justice released a statement that they respectfully disagree with the Supreme Court's ruling on the gun law, New York gun law. The Department of Justice remains committed to saving innocent lives by enforcing and defending federal firearm laws. Okay. That was published as well by ABC News Politics on June 23rd, 2022. Now, hold on just one second here, because that's not nearly the worst thing that Garland's Department of Justice did last week. And here is where, again, the process becomes the punishment, and we see something even, we see a larger agenda at play. In the pre-dawn hours of Wednesday morning last week, we saw more than a dozen federal investigators raid the home of Jeffrey Clark, now think about this. Jeffrey Clark is a former Justice Department official with the Trump administration. So what precipitated this SWAT-type raid? Because Clark had the temerity to investigate claims of voter fraud during the 2020 election. Now, I beg you to stay with me throughout this entire broadcast, because I'm going to be connecting some dots, and it's going to blow your mind how far back and how many people, even as we go further back, how many people are still involved in the process. But okay. His investigation, the mere existence of the investigation, the fact that he had the gall in the Department of Justice's mind to investigate the claims of voter fraud during the 2020 election made Clark a target for House Democrats, their January 6th committee. And you can read this as well. I'm going to scroll down here or scroll up or whatever, and you can read this for yourself. Clark became a target for the House Democrats January 6th committee. I'm going to Washington, D.C., all right, momentarily. As soon as I'm done with this, I'm headed off to Washington, D.C. I'm just going to put a period right there. There's some reading between the lines there. Anyway, and you know that this platform also had sponsored people to go to Washington, D.C., had also aired live that the people there in Washington, D.C., and communicated with people in like InfoWars and other people related to the happenings on January 6th. But I digress. But what was January 6th all about? It was about election integrity. It was about the integrity of the last presidential election, last general election. But the fact that they targeted Jeffrey Clark, who's with a Soviet style, well, let me back up here. That made Clark a target for the House Democrats' January 6th committee, whose Soviet-style show trial spent a great deal of time this past Wednesday implying that Clark, who once oversaw 1,400 lawyers and two divisions at the Department of Justice, is a traitor who tried to overturn the results of the election. Think about that. Now, that should come as no surprise, right, since the entire ostensible reason for the January 6th committee is to smear anyone who, or the reason, of course, is to smear anyone who questioned the outcome of the election or raised any concerns about that. to be a part of the plotting of the coup. Now, I want you to think about this, and think about yourself, and think about the people that you know, and think about your ability to own firearms. I'm going to put another period right there, and how this could possibly relate. But anyone who questioned the outcome of the election or raised concern about its unprecedented irregularities, they've painted as a coup plotter responsible for the January 6th, and in quotations, insurrection. In fact, Jeffrey Clark, his only crime is that a sea of attorneys who didn't want to lift a finger to investigate the election, he looked, I'm sorry, let me read this precisely here. In fact, Clark's only crime is that in a sea of attorneys who didn't want to lift a finger to investigate the election, he looked for options and fought to uncover the truth. That's all he was doing. And so asking questions about the election and looking for others to do the same has now become a participant in a false insurrection, but it's now become an alleged or criminal activity that puts you on a terrorist watch list or paints you as a potential domestic terrorist by Department of Justice Merrick Garland, Merrick Garland's Department of Justice. Now, hold on here, okay? Because this is how they operate. Remember Roger Stone. Remember Peter Navarro and others, many others. Remember the people now still in the gulags in Washington, D.C. Why aren't the media talking about those people who have not been charged, who are there? Why have we seen so much bluster in Congress, yet no one is really doing anything about this? Okay. Let's get back to Clark here. Well, in fact, let's move on from Clark, because he's not the only one the Department of Justice targeted last week. The same day that Clark's house was raided, and this is important, FBI agents raided the home of Michael McDonald, Nevada's top Republican official. His crime now, according to the Department of Justice and the January 6th committee, was signing a document with five other Nevada Republican Party electors, after the 2020 election, signaling their support for Trump. And among the signatories of this purely symbolic document was state GOP Secretary James DeGraffenreid, whom FBI agents tried but failed to find on Wednesday. Now, these are just a few of the people that the January 6th committee had unleashed Garland's Justice Department. So far, the committee has subpoenaed more than 100 lawmakers. And remember my prediction some time ago, saying that charges will be filed against some Congress people. I guarantee, well, I shouldn't say guarantee. I strongly suspect that charges will be filed by the January 6th committee against some current sitting members of Congress. At least one, maybe two, maybe more. I don't know. But they've subpoenaed more than 100 lawmakers. Local officials like McDonald and DeGraffenreid, internet and communications companies, Trump White House officials, and others. Make no mistake, the committee is using the Department of Justice as a weapon against its political enemies, and Garland is allowing this to happen. In fact, he's not just allowing it, he's superintending this whole process. He's going along with this. He's pushing that operation. Writes the author of this article, "We should have seen this coming. From the outset of his tenure, Garland has betrayed a willingness to use the Department of Justice as a partisan weapon. Remember the raid, of course, on Project Veritas on James O'Keefe's home last November, and preceding that, months of illegal spying on Project Veritas. The Biden diary, for example, that's just one example of many, or one reason for that. But even worse in some ways was the October last year, the unprecedented memo designed to threaten and silence parents whose only crime was to speak out about the teaching of critical race theory in schools. Now, Garland smeared them as domestic terrorists and directed the Department of Justice and the FBI to launch a series of additional efforts in the coming days designed to address the rise in criminal conduct directed towards school personnel. This really doesn't exist, or if it does, it's such a small percentage that it doesn't warrant the Department of Justice to even become involved. It's a local matter. And I've seen nothing to indicate otherwise, and I've looked very deeply. So they've weaponized this, and this is where you and I are heavily involved in this. What I believe they will be doing, and this is going to connect to this social credit score that I've got over here. They are going to be coming after you and I if we show in any way, shape, or form a bias toward normalcy, a bias toward a bias against perversity, a bias or a favoritism toward normal teaching, teaching of normal subjects, for example, in a normal fashion. This, they can't allow this to stand. And Garland will be he will be the point man for the Department of Justice, but not calling the shots, just enforcing the issue. All right, so we have that, but this about this rise in criminal conduct, it's just fiction. Garland got it from a letter sent to Joe Biden by the National School Boards Association. Now, this is going to play into something, this is going to kind of connect to something I'm going to play here from 1983. Think about that. Okay. Oh, this has been going on so long, and they've been preparing this for so long. Now they are pulling the trigger. Okay. Why? Because they have to. They have to. I hope this is making sense. And folks, by the way, Do me a favor, leave a comment in the comment section at Rumble or Brighteon. Okay, we are on Rumble, we're on Brighteon. Of course, we're on Spreaker, a number of audio platforms, a couple of stations in the Midwest. I don't even know what they are, frankly. But leave your comments at Rumble and Brighteon, and weigh in on this. But the National School Board Association wrote a letter to Biden saying this is intolerable. We can't have these parents coming to our meetings and threatening our teachers and threatening our school board members, which they're not doing. They're not doing. But they've not threatened with acts of violence. They've objected to the perverse materials being used for that are not age appropriate. But, and again, objected to the critical race theory, all white people are bad people, curriculum that is being taught all across America. So less than a week after that letter was sent, and remember, this goes back last year now, but it goes back even further, because you'll see. And you'll see what ultimately happened to the individual who really put it out there on crossfire. I'll just give you a hint there. Remember that? Okay. Garland's memo appeared right after that. So it was a transparent ploy to get the federal government to intimidate parents into silence and suppress their First Amendment rights, which Garland was happy to do. And remember, the First Amendment is only allowed because the Second Amendment stands. But at every turn, Garland has shown himself to be hostile to the Bill of Rights and to law-abiding Americans who exercise those rights, and beholden to the Democrat partisans. and left-wing advocacy groups. He brazenly allowed political influence, and in fact, based on everything I've seen, encouraged it, to direct the Justice Department's considerable powers. If you think Garland's Department of Justice is not a threat to the Republic, then you need to start paying attention, because the weaponization of federal law enforcement under Biden and Garland is going to get much worse. It will get much worse. This I promise you. That you don't need to be an investigator or have a crystal ball to see that. All right. You really don't. All right, before I switch the topics into a related topic, I do want to mention, I want to thank one of my corporate sponsors, a really good corporate sponsors, ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com. Now, if you're a business owner, let me add to this, ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. So if you are a business owner, please pay attention to this. It could be a small business, it could be a big business, whatever, it doesn't matter. You know, there are so many things to do, of course, during the summer. And, why take the time? Why take the time out to spend looking for that right applicant for your job? Folks, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. And, let them do the hiring for you. ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. It's the smartest way to hire. All right. Now, getting back to something here. This is another thing that's been happening over the weekend. And I want to expand on my suspicion that something very, very ugly, something bad is going to be taking place with the Supreme Court justices. I want to point this out. We monitor various groups, both visible and even on the dark web. And I use that dark web, perhaps not completely accurate because there is a dark web, but we monitor a lot of different groups. But on the socialist Reddit group, in fact, the Reddit group is called Workers Strike Back. They have been posting the home addresses of Supreme Court justices. They've discussed hunting them down at their churches. One TikTok user hinted at using pipe bombs in retaliation to Roe v. Wade reversal. One of the top posts in this socialist subreddit featured the addresses of Supreme Court justices that voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Reddit users in the anti-capitalist group discussed hunting down the Supreme Court justices at their churches and possibly sending them mail bombs. Now, the group in Reddit is a self-described, and I quote, leftist, anti-capitalist, socialist subreddit that is dedicated to support worker strikes, protests, and unions all over the world, address the obvious problems related to an average worker's workplace, offer advice to a fellow worker struggling with their workplace problems, and mock or satirize any kind of anti-work sentiment. End quote. That's their description. Posted in this group are the home addresses of Supreme Court Justices Brett Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas, John Roberts, Samuel Alito, Amy Coney Barrett, and Neil Gorsuch. You notice who's missing. Now, as of Sunday night, the post doxing the Supreme Court justices had been allowed up in the in that group. It had been allowed online for over 22 hours. The post received nearly 27,000 upvotes, kind of like a thumbs up. Out of 97,000 users. think about that. All right. Excuse me. Now, I had said that I was going to connect some dots here. You know, about the weaponization of our Department of Justice and who's calling the shots. I want to go back in time a little bit, just a little bit. And I want to show you something from 1983. I don't know how many people are familiar with Larry McDonald. In 1983, on September 1st, he was killed in the Korean airliner takedown, KAL-007 flight number, was shot down by a Russian fighter jet when reportedly that flight strayed into Russian airspace. You may remember this, you may not. Interestingly, in the summer of 1983, Larry McDonald gave an interview on the program Crossfire. Now, Larry McDonald was attempting to, he was interviewed as a member, leader, the director at that time, the new director of the John Birch Society. And of course, if you know about the John Birch Society, they've got a long history of attempting to expose this New World Order, one world government agenda. Well, here is this interview. Now, I want to play most of it because I think it's a really enlightening and interesting, the questions, the mockery, but the insight by McDonald, by what he was saying and attempting to say in 1983. And think about that. That's 39 years ago right now. He was attempting to expose this conspiracy that we're seeing play out right now. And if you haven't seen this before, I think you're in for a treat. Now, I know that there's kind of a gain problem here. You may hear like a rather annoying buzz or hum in the background. Just try to get through that. Hopefully we can get the filters to tamp that down a little bit. But listen to what's said here. I think you're going to be really surprised at this particular, at the information passed along in this particular interview. Here it is, Larry McDonald, and I'm going to let this go for a little bit. I may pause it, but it'll be for brief periods. But please pay attention to this. I think it's worth every minute. And the link, hopefully, if I can get to a place where it's got internet connection and I'm free, I'll put the link in the program description box at thehagmanreport.com. So here, let's see here. Again, how do I do this? Okay, here we go. Here this is, and here's Larry McDonald 39 years ago, about this time, 39 years ago. Here we go.
It's a pretty important quotation.
It's all right. It was made in a pamphlet by a fellow who later headed up a society. Let's say
it was a
dumb statement. The Birch Society was formed in 58. Why are you all now, the John Birch Society, still answering for a statement like that? Why didn't somebody in the Birch Society say, look, our founder made an asinine statement, we don't pay any attention to it, and go on to the future? Why is the John Birch Society, in his phrase, now considered by an awful lot of people who will say, okay, Jerry Falwell, moral majority, new rightists, okay, don't like him. But all of a sudden, when you mention the Birch Society, everybody recoils. Why is that?
The reason is, Tom, of course, we haven't gotten into what the society is. Instead, we have tried to, it's a sort of a classic effort of a straw man that's thrown up where the society never took a position. The society never stated anything about Eisenhower one way or the other. It was never a position of the society.
Was it a problem for the society that its head for 25 years was the man who had made that statement, and his head is not that now?
Well, part of the problem is, Tom, Pat, the actual statement has not been quoted. Mm-hmm. And if anyone wants to take the time to read the politician with the footnotes, they may read it and judge for themselves. But that's not a position one way or the other of the society. And of course, Another small problem is that Mr. Welch did not resign. Actually, this was a move of transition of leadership, of which he was one of the individuals in actively making the transition. He has emerged as a chairman emeritus.
Were you hurt then? I mean, I want to get to the point why the John Birch Society is differentiated from other new right organizations. You can say Conservative Caucus or NCPAC or Conservative Digest, and people say yes, no, but you say the Birch Society and there's a recoil. Even among conservatives who will say, no, don't call me a member of the Birch Society. Now, why is that? Is that partly due to the fact that Bill Buckley's National Review, I think around 1964, read the Birch Society out of the conservative movement? Have you recovered from that?
Well, I think Bill Buckley founded ACU in 65 partly to do that. Elements within National Review have also, beginning in 65, I think very dishonestly, took a very strong tack against the society. The society would actually be termed more of the old right. I think the definition of the new right would be vigorous and post-vigorous.
Okay, but why? I mean, I don't know where you disagree with the new right people, but why are you all, why do you carry around this tarnish, this taint?
Well, let me give you another reason why he carries around the taint.
I'd be glad to give you the answer,
Mr. Welch.
The reason is because the society is the only organization in America that is organized at the grassroots level with paid coordinators, with chapters in the communities all across the country.
Conservative caucus.
Not with chapters, not with a paid field staff all across the country.
But that's organization.
And so the result is that this is the one group, I think, that those who would radically change America seriously fear. And a tremendous campaign was launched in December of 1960. To move to discredit the John Birch Society and, frankly, launched initially on orders coming out of Moscow.
Well, Mr. McDonald, I'm not a conspirator. I think even Buchanan would vouch for that.
Robert Welch.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Is that a conspiracy? Let me just tell you what Newsweek says this. The John Birch Society considers communism only one arm of a master conspiracy in which socialist American insiders are plotting to establish world government. Now, it also says, and here's Director John McManus, that's your public relations director, saying that former Secretary of State Alexander Haig and CIA Director William Casey are two of these master conspirators who are plotting to establish world government. Now, what do you say? You know, that kind of silly, asinine statement is what makes people laugh at the John Birch Society.
Well, Tom, I'm sure being a longstanding member of the Rockefeller apparatus, and as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations of longstanding, you're fully aware that there is an elitist core in this country that has seen value in subsidizing communism, of protecting communism.
It has?
Sure.
You're accusing me of subsidizing communism?
No, I'm saying
because
that
because I happen to belong to a
there is an elite
policy
core.
Study group?
No, wait a minute. There is an elite core in this country that has dominated American society.
Well, I'm not one of
them. Trilateral Commission.
The Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations.
State Department, I suppose.
Well, let's face it. They have dominated the State Department for 40 years, and pretty much openly.
All right, but what are they trying to do?
Well, their objective is to try to bring about a gradual transition in our society, a dissolving of sovereignty and a moving steadily to the left on the political spectrum.
Well, who are they?
Belief, the elitist groups that I mentioned, particularly key individuals and policymakers in the Council on Foreign Relations.
Is the International Monetary Fund part of this?
Well, I would say the International Monetary Fund has certainly been set up for the purpose of facilitating that transfer of sovereignty and transfer of wealth on the road.
All right, we elected Mr. Conservative.
Let me just finish the point, because otherwise we're going to have a lot of unanswered questions. That you are looking at a group that has worked to bring about the dissolution of national sovereignties on the road to world government. And certainly you're familiar with the local professor Carol Quigley, who has been part of your club, in which he admitted all this. And he said in his book, Tragedy and Hope, the only thing I disagree is that we've worked to keep it a secret. And you see Arthur Schlesinger Jr. writing way back in 1947, says, yes, this is the hidden policy of America. But we can't tell the American public because they're too unsophisticated to see the value.
What is the instrumentality of world government? What is
like
the instrumentality?
Of all the things you say about Arthur, that's the silliest statement I ever heard. He never made anything like that.
Well, let me suggest that you read the May-June issue of the Partisan Review of 1947, Tom, and you can read it for yourself. It's called
Schlesinger
Manifesto.
Arthur Schlesinger said there was a conspiracy. A conspiracy to promote communism?
Oh, no, he didn't use the word conspiracy. He said the objective was to bring about...
What kind of nonsense is this?
Well, let me finish. I'll tell you. He said that the objective, the secret policy, which we can't tell the American public because they're not sophisticated enough to see the value, is that through a steady result of erosion of new deals, we bring the American society steadily to the left.
All right.
And through a sound concept of benign containment, we merge into the vital center of the socialist left. Those are his words, not mine.
You think John Kennedy was a member of that conspiracy?
No, let me ask you this. The world federalist movement in the post-war era contained a lot of people who eventually broke with it, and a lot of people thought the UN, in the post-war era, looked toward world government.
Sure.
Indeed, they did, up until 48, 49. But a lot of them said, look, we were utopian. That's over and done with. We can't move. And a lot of them came in Kennedy's government. Schlesinger was in there when they were fighting in Vietnam, launched the effort in Vietnam. Schlesinger was behind the Bay of Pigs. In other words, look, isn't there some move that occurred in the post-war era that now has been dissipated because nobody believes in the utopian ideal of world government anymore?
Well, I think there are those that realize that moving straight from a prototype of the United Nations into world government perhaps is tactically impossible. But phasing out increasingly national sovereignty into regional government and phasing out sovereignties into international treaties in multiple areas could be a route.
The whole movement toward, quote, interdependence.
Yes.
NATO is part of the conspiracy?
Well, there are certainly elements in NATO. There are people in NATO who are very strongly dedicated to the defense of the West. But at the same time, you find in NATO a steady dissolution. You find a growing weakness as a NATO policy dominated by State Department policies that has not worked.
Well, it's a regional grouping, and I think, therefore, it may be suspect by the John Birch Society.
We're talking with Congressman Larry McDonnell, who has recently been elevated, I guess, the chairmanship of the John Birch Society, succeeding Robert Welch. We'll be back in a minute.
Isn't that very interesting, the mockery that you heard? And again, please bear with that background noise.
Welcome back to Crossfire. Our guest is the new chairman, recently named chairman of the John Birch Society, Congressman Larry McDonnell, a Democrat from Georgia. Mr. McDonnell, your predecessor believed that the PTA was too left-wing and that and the John Birch Society at one time tried to infiltrate it. Or so he said. He used the word infiltrate. Is that part of your program
PTA.
Now?
Well, I think when the PTA comes out in his program for the test ban treaty, and when the PTA comes out for gun control, and comes out for obviously national legislative programs that have been linked with liberaldom, having nothing to do with education of our children, I think many people are wondering, what in the world is the PTA doing? And that includes members of the John Birch Society.
Well, I wonder about you.
I
wonder about you. I looked you up. You're the biggest joiner that I've ever seen in the world. You belong,
now,
as
listen.
I counted them, to 67 organizations, among which are the National Rifle Association, the American Pistol and Revolver Association, the Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, the Second Amendment Foundation, and the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms.
Well, Tom, I think there's a real drive in this country to try to destroy the realization of our citizens that they have a fundamental constitutional right to keep and bear arms as the Constitution allows. And unfortunately, there are those in our society, including elements of the PTA nationally, not always locally by any stretch, but nationally, who would believe that the federal government should restrict the right of citizens to keep and bear arms.
Can I get back to that?
What kind of grades do you give Ronald Reagan as president? And what kind of grades does the John Birch Society
This is
give?
Important, too.
Well, I would say in his speeches, Pat, you'd have to give him close to an A, B plus to an A, but in his performance,
what's
somewhere,
most disappointing?
Well, I think the fact that the rhetoric is going one way and the record is going another.
Let me ask you about this conspiracy again.
Well, you can take the issue of one of the major problems of this country is inflation,
right,
and the problems of the destruction of the dollar. And the fact of the matter is, in spite of promises of the contrary, Reagan has not moved to correct the deficiencies. We're now back to Keynesian economics despite comments to the contrary.
Do you think that's a result of the conspiracy you mentioned? Is there somebody working on him to get the inflation so that this country will be weakened?
Well, as a man who campaigned against elitism, as a man who in his campaign rhetoric said that he would not be having the Council on Foreign Relations trilateral types dominating his cabinet, he's got about 250 members of such in his administration.
Well, let me ask
of the trilateral commission.
I've known Bill Casey
in the administration.
I've known Bill Casey, the director of CIA, since World War II. As a matter of fact, in World War II, he was my boss. Now, you're a public relations director of the John Birch Society, says that Bill Casey is a part of this conspiracy that's trying to bring about world government.
Before he became CIA, one of his big jobs was aiding in the transfer of technology and goods and so forth to the Soviet Union, helping the Kama River Project, the Export-Import Bank. Oh, helping to finance these
things. Is the Export-Import Bank part of the conspiracy?
I think the fact that the American people have been tapped steadily, especially since World War II, to finance their enemies and to have the massive technology transfer to those who
were doing it.
You know that from the Braden Doctrine in the agency, which you're very familiar with, and the feeling that we must somehow subsidize the, quote, non-communist left. That's among our so-called allies.
Braden was
and in country after country,
left?
That turned out to be the communists, mm-hmm. the crypto-communists masquerading
yeah,
as
that's
the non-communist.
Yeah, that's Mr. Mitterrand, who has taken the strongest position against the Russians of any Western European
Well,
leader.
He was about to lose everything at the polls, and he had to show some sign. It's very difficult to say exactly how far that will
Congressman
be.
Congressman McDonnell, he's yeah. been using the term conspiracy.
No, I didn't use it. For heaven's sakes, Pat. The John Birch Society used it.
I don't want to go through the tapes.
Well, it is. Don't blame it on me. He used it.
You've used it 45 times.
That's right. They say this is a conspiracy. Right. I want to know what the conspiracy is. Tom. I'm trying to find out who's in it and what agencies of government in it, because I want to fight it along with you.
You look
and
like
great,
Tom. Let me tell you, Tom.
So there you have an interview 39 years ago, and again, I apologize for that hum or that whatever the gain noise was, but if you were able to get through that and listen to the words, there were so many things that came up. And remember, again, I go back to Merrick Garland today talking about the people who are objecting, the parents, think about that, PTA, Parents Teacher Association, but now the parents individually complaining about the curriculum. And we know that CRT is rooted in Marxist communist ideology. Now you've got the actual fighting taking place, very almost prophetic. It didn't have to be necessarily. We could see it 39 years ago taking place and moving forward, the fact that these shadowy corporate entities operating behind the scenes, he mentioned, of course, in addition to these NGOs, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, he appeared. Now, Larry McDonald, by the way, was a Democrat, was considered a leftist back in 1983. Is he talking like that by today's standards? No. But he appeared on Crosstalk. I believe that was September 1st of 83. I'm not exactly sure of the date, but it was definitely 1983, about 4 months before. No, I'm sorry. September 1st was when the airline was taken down. So it was during the summer of 83, Pat Buchanan and Tom Braden on the show Crossfire and the Crosstalk there. So then there was a lot of crosstalk. But do you see everything that he pointed out, everything that he laid out, including Reagan at the time? Hey, speeches sounded great, but in practice, not so great. Okay. And what do we see with President Trump? We saw a lot of the same promises made, promises not kept. Well, why is that? I go back to the infiltration, which again, McDonald talked about, but the infiltration by members of different organizations. You've heard it before, the World Economic Forum. They're boasting and bragging about these young people being pushed into various parts of government, including and especially the State Department, other places like the CIA, and various other departments all across our government, Western governments in general, United States government departments specifically. So you heard all of that, again, 39 years ago. And where are we today? Now we're seeing the plans that were being put into action back 40 years ago. And this does go into the... he references, if he didn't already reference, and I know he does it again, what we're seeing, what they saw then, the outgrowth from the 60s and the 70s, the movements, the Workers' Party at that time. But it's the same today. Now, some of the names have been changed, but the objectives are the same, and that's to take down the United States, to neuter the leadership, the constitutional parts of the United States, to take down our constitutional republic. So it's not a roadblock to this one world, new world order, one world government. And again, the other organizations, the organization that existed at that time as well was the World Economic Forum, which was started in 1971. There's a lot of cross-pollination between these groups, political ideology. But now, today, the important part of all of this in the dot connecting process, from my investigative analysis, is you are seeing the execution of the ideology, of the plans that were laid in place back then, today. That's the important part of this. At least I believe that. And we're seeing that too with the formation, or with the added push by organizations such as BlackRock. And again, this is extremely important because I have a document here. Let me find it. A report here. Okay. The White House's secret meetings with BlackRock. Now, this is an interesting report because we talk about BlackRock and Vanguard and who's really running things, who's really running the White House, who's pushing the policy, right? We talk about this. But with more than $10 trillion in assets now under management, BlackRock is the wealthiest and most powerful investment management firm on Wall Street. There's been newly discovered information that reveals BlackRock's influence may extend well beyond the financial sphere, all the way to the White House. All right. The relationship between BlackRock officials and the White House shows that while Biden sat, you know, that potato sat in the Oval Office, BlackRock, which currently controls more assets than any other investment group in America, had unfettered access and still has unfettered access to key administration figures and advisors to Biden, the Biden regime. And these relationships raise very serious ethical concerns that can't be addressed without proper investigation. You've got to have that. But we don't have that through a weaponized Department of Justice. But we can expose it at this point. We can talk about it. You and I can talk about it. So some of BlackRock's most powerful executives have been at the White House numerous times, have met with Biden's people numerous times, many on a near monthly basis. This is where it gets really interesting. For example, White House visitor logs show Tom Donilon, the chairman of BlackRock Investment Institute. That's BlackRock's think tank, okay? It's dedicated to addressing and assessing and implementing geopolitical investment risk. He convened with Biden administration officials at least 8 times between March and November of 2021. Okay, so that's a significant amount of time and number of meetings. Donilon has been a luminary in U.S. foreign policy his entire career. He had served as the national security advisor to Obama. And here's Obama again. He's not left. He's still hanging around along with Jarrett and others. He's been a national security advisor to Obama and foreign policy lead for the 2016, guess who, Hillary Clinton campaign. Leading member of globally focused organizations such as, you ready, Council on Foreign Relations. What do we hear 39 years ago? The Aspen Strategy Group And get, what did we hear 39 years ago? The Trilateral Commission, Braden, and even Pat Buchanan at the time attempted to downplay the role of these organizations. There's exhibit A, perhaps, in a courtroom setting, if you will, of what's been taking place. Now, you have to understand that White House visitor logs are detained. I mean, they're not immediately released. They're released after several months after the meetings occur. So it's possible, it's entirely possible, looking back at that time period, that Donilon or people in his stead had additional meetings that we don't know anything about. Yet, using the data that we have to date, records show that Donilon has met multiple times with specific assistants to the White House Office of Cabinet Affairs, Thomas Eisen, Samuel Rastegar, and others. And I'm just going through here. And once with Cezanne Seymour, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology at the National Security Council. All right. This is an interesting name and someone that, folks, if you can find out anything about this individual, and I'm not sure, I do know that other platforms have mentioned this name. That name is Kimberly Lang. White House records show that Donilon has met at least four times, had one-on-one meetings with someone named Kimberly Lang. Now, there was an investigation done to find out who Kimberly Lang is, what Lang's role is in the White House under this regime. No one can find any job description for Kimberly Lang. Lang appears to be absent from the Office of Annual Report to Congress on White House Office Personnel. That's as of, they file those annually, and that was last one dated July 1st, 2021. Despite having many meetings prior to that, even prior to the report's release, the only record of her existence comes from federal payroll records, which indicate that she worked with the National Security Council in 2016 and had the highest salaried government position obtainable, which was a GS-13 rank. Huh. So in her current unspecified role, the White House visitor logs portray that Lang holds regular and private meetings with top foreign policy and national security elites. Of the 308 meetings she has personally hosted as of February of this year, this gets deep, I'm telling you. Some of her visitors have included Bill Burns, William Burns, the director of the CIA, Colin Kale, U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and other people, other high-ranking officials as well. Lang also met with numerous prominent political scientists and experts specializing in geopolitical risks, nuclear threats, terrorism, and economic sanctions. So who is this person? Hey, if you know, please send me an email, doug@hagmanreport.com, two ends on Hagman. Seriously, we need to find out more about this Kimberly Lang. But Donilon and Lang have been in close contact since, going back to 2010, when Donilon was National Security Advisor to the Obama regime, during which he ran the National Security Council, to which Lang had been linked. And according to various emails obtained from WikiLeaks, that's a whole nother discussion, but we need to have about WikiLeaks and about the founder and about the extradition and such. But again, Lang was closely apprised of Donilon's whereabouts often directly communicating with him in addition to powerful government officials, such as former Secretary of State, back then Hillary Diane Rodham Clinton, and Jake Sullivan, the current National Security Advisor. So when you look at this, this is pretty, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. Now, as far as recent White House meetings between Donilon and Lange, there are no publicly available records about the purpose, nor have there been public statements made by Biden or anybody close to that, or BlackRock for that matter, or Donilon. And no responses have been received from various requests from various agencies. And again, these meetings, why should we care? Well, they raise, again, serious ethical concerns, especially in light of the fact that the stated mission of BlackRock Investment Institute, if you look at that and about how they influence policy decisions, we need to know who these people are. The fact that an important figure at BlackRock had numerous closed-door meetings at the White House throughout 2021 is, look, that is troubling enough, right? But Donilon's connections to the Biden White House, the Biden regime, they run much deeper than monthly meetings with policymakers. Not only did Donilon work alongside Biden in Obama's regime as well as National Security Advisor, he was also reportedly on Biden's shortlist to become the CIA director. Then again, this is BlackRock's director, Thomas Donilon. Now, his brother, Mike Donilon, just to keep this in the family, is the senior advisor to Biden's closest, one of Biden's closest confidants. Michael Donilon served as Biden's chief strategist throughout the 2020 presidential campaign. Think, folks, 39 years ago, all these, the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, how do I join the John Birch Society? Ha ha ha. Look, the connections are out there. Carol Quigley, who's that? I don't know. Yes, you do. Okay. Thomas Donilon's wife, and this is pretty interesting, Kathy Russell, was head of the White House personnel office during Biden's first year there. Where did she go to after that? She went to become the executive director of UNICEF on February 1st of this year. Okay. Kathy Russell was vested with the important task of hiring and vetting administration employees while at the White House. And I should add this, Donilon's daughter, Sarah, also works in the Biden White House as a staffer for the National Security Council. You can't make this up. Look at these connections. It still doesn't answer the question, who is this Kimberly Lange? Inquiring minds want to know. So, you know, BlackRock, again, think of the magnitude of this organization, but the connections don't end with Biden. Or the BlackRock's connections with the Biden regime don't end with the Donilon family. You've got others involved. You got Brian Deese, Biden's director of National Economic Council, former global head of sustainable investing at BlackRock. And I could go on and on and on. I will say this. William, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this right, Adeyemo was the deputy secretary of the Treasury Department's he previously worked as senior advisor at BlackRock and served as chief of staff to BlackRock's chairman, CEO Larry Fink. And here we have Fink again. Fink also has had at least one unpublicized meeting with the Biden regime. It was February 8th, 2022, just 2 weeks before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Is that timing of importance? Perhaps. Is it coincidental? Nothing. I don't think it's coincidental. Fink met with this Steve Ricchetti, the counselor to the president, to the office of the president. And somebody this guy's dubbed Biden's Sherpa by Politico. But the media remains uninterested. The question remains at the end of the day, right now, as we kind of wrap this up, why are members of the Biden regime meeting frequently with key figures at BlackRock? Have the close relationships between BlackRock's executives and the White House impacted public policy? And if so, we deserve to know that. Who is actually making these policy decisions? And which way does the money travel? Does it travel to the White House, from the White House, both ways? Again, BlackRock is the world's most powerful investment management firm. So we need to know answers to these questions and many other important questions as well. The American people, we as the American people, need and deserve these answers. And if you look at that Democrat back, if you look at the Democrat 39 years ago, right? As you saw in Crossfire, Crosstalk, there with Pat Buchanan and Tom Braden, and of course the Democrat I'm referring to is Larry McDonald, who was killed in that KAL 007 airline takedown on September 1st, 1983. I think a lot of those concerns highlighted in 1983 are not only apparent, but are being executed today. So that's kind of the long, it's kind of an in-depth report, I believe. And the reason I wanted to play that video clip, folks, look, what we're seeing today, I believe, is the culmination of everything. And speaking of the culmination of everything, Dr. Dave Janda had on his Operation Freedom podcast, had a gentleman on, and excuse my looking away here. I'm going to see if I can't get this properly, to display properly here. Harley Schlanger talking about the globalists who are targeting our freedoms and our future. Now, I'm going to start this about 3 minutes into the Operation Freedom podcast from June 27th. I guess that was published just today. Okay, so have a listen and take a look at this as Harley Schlanger is talking about the globalists targeting our freedom and our future. Now, I think a lot of good points here are raised. I'm not going to let this play too long, just a couple of minutes to give you an idea. And again, I would urge you to go to Operation Freedom to listen to the entire audio clip. So what I'm going to do, let's see if I can do this without any issues. And I think I can. I'm impressed. Here we go. Have a listen. Have a look.
You know, Harley, many people, when I speak about this New World Order crowd, they said, this is conspiracy theory. This isn't. I want to play a brief clip from globalist extraordinaire George H.W. Bush. He gave this speech in the Oval Office in around the 1992 time frame. I just want to play this brief clip and get your reaction, Harley.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, We have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
That was 9/11.
Harley, your take.
1991.
Well, that whole idea is collapsing, rapidly. Mm-hmm. And there's a growing panic among the people who are the advocates of the what Bush is talking about, which they now call the rules-based order. This is the Davos crowd. It's the City of London. They've run the world into the ground. And for some reason, they think military operations might scare enough countries to continue to stick with their system. But I want to focus on two sets of conferences that are taking place right now. The globalists are meeting with the G7 in Bavaria the next couple of days. They just had a European Union heads of state meeting. They will also have a NATO meeting in Madrid at the end of the month, where they're about to identify what they call global NATO. Now, at the same time, something that very few Americans know about, the BRICS, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, had a conference where they discussed a new financial system. They discussed a financial system based on what are, in reality, the principles of the American system of physical economy. Most interesting in this was Putin's address. Putin has been speaking quite often recently on what's going on with the Western economy. And he made a quip, the only thing they seem to have that's producing anything is the money printing machines of the central banks. What he then said is blaming Russia for inflation is crazy. The inflation is the result of failed and bad monetary policies by the caretakers of the Western system. And he went on to talk about the zero interest rates, the buildup of a speculative bubble, of an unsustainable debt. In fact, Dave, he sounded a lot like you and me in his speech at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And then he went beyond that at the BRICS meeting in Beijing, where he said, we're talking about a new foreign exchange system, which could include the dollar, but would also be based on other currencies. And this is what's in the works right now. Because unlike the nonsense that people in the West are reading in the press about the wonderful struggle in Ukraine and how Russia's collapsing, actually it's the West that's collapsing. We're undergoing an economic collapse, inflation, supply chain breakdowns. This has nothing to do with Putin. All of this, and it has nothing to do with COVID. All of this was in full steam ahead since 2008. And on top of that, according to people like Scott Ritter, Colonel Richard Black, Douglas MacGregor, the Ukraine war is lost. The only question is how many more Ukrainians will be killed while NATO continues its buildup and attempt to destroy Russia. So this is an extraordinary moment where our enemies, the globalists that you talked about in the introduction, are on the defensive. They don't have the support anymore of countries like India, even Brazil, which they thought they had with Bolsonaro. Brazil is breaking to support Russia and China. Nigeria, Algeria, Argentina wants to join the BRICS. Indonesia, I think the fifth largest country in the world in population, wants to join the BRICS. And what are we doing with the G7? We're giving observer status to Zelensky. So I think the...
So let me pause that right there. Remember that opening clip of Pelosi giving that shove to that little girl? Obviously, look, it could just be a speck of dust in this dirt pile of evidence, okay? But I'm telling you right now, what I am seeing with the actions, the activities, the behavior, specifically the behavior, I'm seeing a group of elitists becoming very frustrated, very scared, very alarmed, very emotionally unwound. And that's why I think that was important. Now, I could be wrong. I could be absolutely making something totally you know, I could be making a big deal out of nothing, but I just think that that's just something that we should be taking a look at. That's my view of things. By the way, again, I want to thank ZipRecruiter, ziprecruiter.com/Hagman. Look, I know a lot of people are very excited to travel this summer. Have you thought about all the people who really come together to make your vacation a great one if you're going to travel? Have you thought about that? How many people it takes to make your vacation truly great? I mean, if I travel, and no, I'm traveling today, okay? The hotel concierge who knows the best places to go, if you stay at a hotel that has a concierge, and I hope you get a chance to do so. How about the tour guide, for example, if you're in an area foreign to you, tour guide that is filled with great stories. Well, you get the idea. The wait staff at popular restaurants, the people you meet, the friendly people that you meet. You know, outstanding talent is crucial for every successful business. And if you're hiring, you can find talent for roles like these and more at ZipRecruiter when you try for free at ziprecruiter.com/Hagman. Now, folks, business owners, I really want you to do this. I'm telling you, this works. I can prove it with business owners I know and have used ZipRecruiter. They use their powerful technology to find and match the right candidates for your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates, invite your top choices to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day, which is no wonder. No wonder why ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site based on G2 satisfaction ratings as of January 1st of 2022. So travel to this easy to remember web destination. Just remember this URL. ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. That's 2 N's on Hagman. That's where you can try ZipRecruiter for free. I'm telling you, it's free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. Try ZipRecruiter for free. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/Hagman. It's HAGMANN. ZipRecruiter, that's the smartest way to hire. I'm telling you, if you're a business owner and you're looking for that certain individual or individuals, you'll thank me later. You will. All right. Just to wrap this up, because I really want to finish hard with this. We're seeing a lot of things take place right now that are intertwined. We're going to see shortages coming up. But these are planned shortages. But why are we going to see them now? If you go back to that video 39 years ago, there's a lot there to digest and unpack and look at it through the lens of history over the last 4 decades. The pinch is on right now. The last throes of a desperate regime, it's on. You know, I know. Everyone knows the elephant in the room, at least this is what I believe, that Joe Biden didn't get 81 million votes. The election was stolen. So how can you fight that with facts? How can you fight that with facts? You can't. You have to stop any facts from being brought out. Of course, we've talked about this before. So what do? You weaponize the Department of Justice, going back to the beginning. You infiltrate government departments and shut down the nodes of communication or the nodes of operation. This is what we're seeing today. So everything that was planned out decades and really a century plus ago, being refined ever since, is playing out today. So we are right now in a very critical moment in history, I believe, and I think you would agree with me on this. Right now, they are trying to kill us. They're trying to enslave us. They're trying to starve us. they're trying, we see this, they're trying to take away our selection and our ability to buy food or ability to buy groceries. They're going to, you know, the old saying that they have, you can eat bugs because they're nutritious. My goodness, I saw a clip about from the World Economic Forum. In fact, I might even have it. Let me see if I have this, because this would be worth taking a look at. Let me see if I have this one here. I don't have it available right off, but you may have seen these videos where there are gourmet chefs actually saying, well, you know what, there's protein in insects, we can serve them up, they'll be palatable to people, and that will solve a lot of our climate issues next to come. But we're in for this period now, as the elite group of individuals now are shutting things down. They're playing their last round, I think, at the blackjack table or at the poker table, where now they've got to make the moves, because more and more people are waking up. Despite the fact that more and more people are purposely being dumbed down, but more and more people are starting to wake up, especially the ones who are actively doing things. Again, parents for the school district. But so they've got to really increase the pressure. And not that I want to end on you know what, I'm not going to do that. I was going to show you something that happened in Seattle. And of course, you know, parents bringing their children out to see these pride parades. I, for the life of me, I cannot really fathom what these parents, what these people are thinking. To me, that's child abuse. Were there nude people dancing around, nude adults in the faces of children? And this, in sum and substance, is what parents, among other things, are fighting against in the schools. Which, by the way, I should add, that's why Steve and I had Skipper founders on last week. If you didn't hear that program, listen to it again. Talk about homeschooling and the ability to create the school, so to speak, of your choice, a curriculum of your choice for your child. That is so valuable today. So there are ways to defeat these people, but the fact is they're doubling down now. So expect things like war with Russia, the proxy war that the U.S. is having with Russia, especially since it's become known that the CIA and military have assets over in Ukraine that are fighting against Russian interests. You don't think that's going to have implications? Of course it will. Take a look at the bigger picture. Please, I would urge you to do that. And I hope this kind of at least put together certain things for you, showing you that, you know what, we are following China, for example, in imposing things like a social credit score. We are imposing this restrictive, or we are being having imposed upon us this restrictive series of policies. We are now the enemy, and we have to fight back accordingly. But at least now, I think that the elitist leaders are getting a little bit nervous that, hey, we've got your number. They're like that subject in the interview or interrogation room I spoke of. Hey, do you think they know that, you know, do you think they know? I think they know. That's them. And if we unite, and I think we can, if we unite and push back, I really believe we can change the course of history. All right. With that, gotta go. Don't forget, tune in tomorrow and Wednesday as well. Randy Taylor will be joining me in both days. I hope that you had I hope you got some good information out of this broadcast. Let me know in the in the comments section at Rumble or Brighteon. I appreciate you and I thank you. And oh, don't forget to sign up for our fundraiser as well. Steve Quayle, myself, putting together that marvelous expedition. Go to HagmanReport.com, click on the banner, you'll see it there. The actual material will come out on July 30th. You can pre-register now for our mini conference. All right, with that, may God bless. Stay safe, folks. Good night.